is Upfront on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganya. Thank you for joining us today on the show. Whether you're listening in live on radio or via our podcasts, remember we are also on all social media platforms, on Twitter, on Instagram, and on Facebook. So as we enter into the 14th month since the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 as a global pandemic, it is calling on governments not to lose focus on existing public health problems, including violence against women, which is a public health problem that affects every level of society around the world. The 1993 Vienna Declaration on Human Rights and the 1995 Declaration of the Fourth World Conference on Women in Beijing called for the elimination of all forms of violence against women that include physical violence, sexual harassment, forced marriage, and many other forms of abuse that negatively affect women's physical, mental, sexual, and reproductive health. Now, women's rights advocates say that even with these global conventions and protocols signed by governments around the world, that violence against women and girls is one of the most widespread human rights violations. Studies show that many communities, and this is not limited to rural communities or rural areas, still maintain customs and practices that perpetuate violence against women, with many of these women and girls often suffering in silence and often failed by the criminal justice and court systems that are supposed to protect them. Our next guest, Tabitha Mamira, says that this silence is also passed down from one generation to the next, often by mothers to their daughters, as a form of survival mechanism. She says that this often leads to repeated experiences of silencing that ultimately have long-term consequences on the health of the girls. Tabitha is the founder of EDGER, an initiative that is working to break the cycle of sexual violence in rural communities in Uganda. She joins me from Michigan and starts off by telling us how this journey started off for her.
Kind of a long story. As we know, life never goes in a straight line. So there's seeds that are planted along the way. And then there's that one aha moment where you can't look away anymore. So my first initial knowledge in wanting to do this was in 10th grade, moved to the US in 10th grade as a 14-year-old. I'm from Rwanda, so we know our history of trauma and genocide. And I went into psychology class. And that was the first time I heard about this idea of healing the mind. And that was the first moment I knew this is what I wanted to do with my life. So from 14, I knew I wanted to be a psychologist. I just didn't know what that meant. All I knew was that I could make a difference in healing my people. Mm. And then fast forward, the aha moment part was in 2015, as I went to, and along the way I had worked with, as a therapist, with women in Rwanda who had survived the genocide and had been raped, had children out of these rapes. I had worked in research labs around sexual violence, understanding how that works. But the big aha moment that got me on this journey, to answer your question, was in 2015. I went to Uganda in this village trying to do some volunteer work at a nonprofit. And while there, I'm asking around what I can do in terms of therapy for these children who are mainly orphans to HIV and AIDS and their grandparents, because most of them had lost their parents to this epidemic. And this teacher says very nonchalantly that a 9-year-old had been raped the day before and she was in class, and they were just saying it as business as usual, like, maybe you could start there. And I'm like, what? And I bring this little girl out of class and we're talking. I'm doing a little crisis counseling, and it turns out it wasn't even the first time. And while I'm there, two other girls come forward after I helped this girl, because it turns out you have to pay for the police to make an arrest. You have to pay to get to go to the hospital. So two other girls come forward, and the one case that really like pushed me over the edge was a 5-year-old. And I think we should warn your listeners that these stories are kind of triggering, and they're relating to, I'm sure they'll already know that this is the topic, but this 5-year-old had been assaulted by her own grandfather, who was HIV positive, and they couldn't raise the money in that time, like $5, literally $5, to get a appeal. That would have stopped it. Yes, thank you, Pip. So she was now HIV positive. And Grandpa couldn't be put away in jail either, because you have to pay for that too. And it was very clear to me. It was almost like a literal voice. I was thinking, okay, at the time I was doing my PhD, I was raising three little ones, I was working. I'm like, I can't take this on. I don't have the time, money, energy.
Wait, so first of all, just for clarification, you say they need money to actually to go to the police, to call the police?
Yes. So you call the police.
Case, you need money.
Transport.
That's so sad. That's so sad. So these kids who were in your class had been victims of sexual violence, and you were there for different purpose altogether.
Yeah, I was visiting. This was in my ex-husband's village. We had gone to visit at the time I was married to him, and I'm visiting with some other guests who were there to volunteer. And that came up in the conversation. And so that's when that nine-year-old, it turns out, so if you can't afford to pay the police and your perpetrator knows you can't, but you really are still pushing forward. For this little girl, he came and offered them a goat so that they don't report. Mm. Like, here's a goat.
Some sort of compensation?
Yeah. Can you imagine? Like, that's a message they're giving this girl.
Where are the parents of this nine-year-old? It feels, for some reason, that there's a certain normalization that is taking place in this village around that issue, that even a crime of that nature, you know, heinous crime of that nature, is kind of swept under the rug, and the goat is brought in as a way to compensate and kind of just forget everything.
So it can be both and, right? So there is that. So for this little girl specifically, Grandma was really trying to get justice for her, but she doesn't have the money it takes to go through. The perpetrator has more resources, so sometimes they give the judges or the police more money. So by the time you report, they're like, yeah, 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 we'll come back tomorrow. And they keep pushing it until you can't afford it.
Wow, they basically corrupted the justice system. The abusers or the perpetrators kind of know how to go about corrupting the system.
Exactly. So there is that part of corruption. But then there is also, and sometimes it's easier for people to think, oh, this is some village in Uganda, they are so backwards, they don't think this is a crime. Because on the books, Uganda actually says those people are punishable, some of them by death, some of them, it says the law says life in prison. I think they changed it to life in prison. So the laws on paper look amazing.
Right.
But think about the same thing.
But the implementation is not there.
It's not there.
Okay, right. So you're saying that even in more developed countries where they have laws and a much more robust justice system, that even the injustice still happens around these issues of sexual violence.
And there's a minimization of what it is, or a silence around it. So whether somebody gives a goat or somebody goes to court and pays off a big amount and it's silenced, it is overall globally the same issue. It just kind of shows up differently.
Differently.
Yes.
Okay. So you, and then for you, this was your trip to go volunteer at this school. It turns out something else. And that's, I guess, that was the genesis of EDGE Foundation.
Correct. So not only I see these girls needing something right now, right there, and I get this voice saying, well, why do you get the luxury to wait? I was thinking, oh, I will do this work someday when I have degrees and I have this and I have resources. But it was like, but what, the problem is in your face right now. And the other part was, when I was talking to this little girl, it was literally like looking in the mirror, and it was so clear that either I was being a hypocrite, or I didn't think I deserved what I was giving. And I say that to say, as an 11-year-old, I had experienced that same thing that I was trying to help her through, but I had never told anyone. And these girls gave me that courage to say, me too. And that's why Me Too went viral the way it did, because every survivor wants to hear that they're not alone. They want to be validated. They want to be like, right, this is reality.
Right.
So those girls also gave me that courage to go and do my own work around my healing. And that also helped Eja become more authentic for me as I help other people through that same process.
Mm. And I saw your talk recently. You called it the baton talk, mm-hmm. kind of touching upon some of the themes that perpetuate this type of culture. Let's talk about the batons, the legacy, the baggage, the experiences of our parents that are passed on to us. What are those batons that were passed on to you?
Ooh, that could be a whole thing, right? So we inherit something, right? A lot of things. We inherit through messaging, how our parents, our communities, our societies have told us who we are. But also there is this unseen inheritances of trauma. And now more research shows epigenetics, like in your DNA, you are literally carrying your mother's stress, your mother's trauma.
Mother's baggage.
Her baggage. And she was carrying her mother's baggage, and her mother was carrying, so it keeps being passed down unless somebody breaks that cycle. Like, unless you go and clearly, intentionally say, nope, this is where it stops. Mm. But most people...
Identify what that baggage is.
Yeah. And get it out of that.
Get it out of the way, yes.
Yeah. And scientifically, some researchers have said it sometimes evolutionarily is to help you cope with the environment you're coming into.
Correct.
So that's why part of why the genes show up that way is that if your mother is pregnant with you during a war, some of that DNA helps you then if you're born in a war-torn area that you have the capacity to handle it.
Mm.
And if somebody's born in a peaceful place, they don't need to have that. Anyway, so that's kind of the behind the scenes. So for me, a part of that was my mom was pulled out of school at a young age. She was almost married off at 14. And that story was shared in that TED Talk as well, where she was able to get away.
And we will share the link to... for our listeners to actually watch that TED Talk, one of the most powerful TED Talks I've actually watched. Yeah, so go ahead.
Thank you. That's a big compliment. So there are those pieces, and then there's the patriarchy, which my mom really overcame. She was the breadwinner for our family for a long time. My dad decided to go back to school after having all four kids, and my mom, without an education, put all of us through school, including her own husband.
Including her own husband.
Including her husband, who wanted to pursue this education that he wasn't able to get.
And, that's amazing.
Right?
That's amazing.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upfront on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Our guest today is Tabitha Mamira, a mental health therapist and activist against sexual and gender-based violence.
You know, Toni Morrison, the great Toni Morrison, writes that... you know, about love, that each generation has a kind of love, and some of it is really tough. Would you say the tough love is also part of the baton that is passed on?
Yes, and sometimes it can be helpful, right? So the intention behind the tough love, because sometimes as we see the history of, let's say, African Americans coming through slavery, and our disciplinary ways have been sometimes physical, right? Like whooping kids as a way of disciplining, which is how they were disciplined as slaves. And so then the idea, the intention might be good, that I want to teach my children to stay in the right path.
And to survive.
To survive and to stay safe. And if I do it myself, that they don't have to get in trouble, then I keep them safe in the outside world.
Mm.
I think Ta-Nehisi Coates really also talked through that.
Absolutely, in his book with the in his letter to his son.
Yes. Then if they do it in home, then they can keep them safe off the streets. And so sometimes we're also passing on that trauma of, now I'm physically abusing my child out of love, right? My intention is better than what the master's intention was.
But the purpose is kind of the same. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the effects kind of the same too. So until we have to continue.
That's very important. The effects are kind of the same too.
Yes.
Wow.
And so we have to always ask.
As traumatic as the experience was, it still is. It never changes.
Yes.
Because the methods are the same.
The methods you're using are the same. So your intention doesn't change the impact. And so asking forever, why do I do what I do? Of every time, especially when we have children, you're passing on so much baggage that you don't even understand. And I catch myself, you know, most of us, I had somebody say, the first thing that comes to mind anytime is what you've been conditioned to do. You know, we're always being conditioned. And the second piece is who you are, right? So usually if your child does something, for me, my first thing is like yelling.
I think that's the one word every diaspora kid knows who doesn't speak our language. They know Ndagu Kubita.
Yeah, and they think it means stop it. So I didn't correct them. I was like, sure, that's what it means. But that's why we've been conditioned.
Let's take a quick break and listen to some vox pops on the streets of an African city. This week we asked you about the COVID-19 vaccines. And this is what you had to say.
My name is Lamson Lacoigne. I've not been vaccinated as yet because at the moment the vaccination is being done, but mostly officials. So I've not had the opportunity. Yeah, I would be willing to be vaccinated very much because I'm a man of the people.
I'm Daisy Asasra. And I've not been vaccinated. Reason asked why. I don't know of any hospitals that are vaccinating. We hear in rumors it could be chargeable. So I have not gotten vaccinated yet. That's the reason. Because I don't know of any hospital that is vaccinating right now. I do not know of any citizens like us, the normal citizens, the down people.
My name is Vesgam Kama Levis. Yes, I'm a student of Makerere University Business School. I haven't been vaccinated. Reason one is because I think the process is not yet on ground.
My name is Leander Patrick, head coach of the Bombers. Yes, I've been vaccinated. The process was not bad. A matter of fact, we went with the whole team, and then we took our shots. Then they told us to relax there for like 30 minutes, but it all came out fine, so we're released to go home.
If you're just joining us, welcome. You're listening to Upfront on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Our guest today is Tabitha Mamira, a mental health therapist and activist against sexual and gender-based violence.
Are there some, what we would say, are positive batons and that kind of help you navigate life as an adult when you grow up and say, you know, this might have been a baton passed down to me, but I'm using it in a way to help me go through life?
Oh, for sure. Because I think our ancestors, our parents, went through much harder lives than we're going through. And they did most of that so we can have a better life, right?
Right.
And so part of those, what they're handing down to us, some of that is resilience. What are the things that they used in their own lives to make it through, the lives they made through? For us to be here now in the U.S., educated, they had to make some sacrifices, and that took a lot of creativity. They were very creative people. They were able to make do with the little they had. A lot of them had really, their faith gave them that hope. Community, how they relied on each other and showed up for each other, that now we're more isolated than they were. So finding, they all built tribes. Around their, even those in, I mean, I grew up as a refugee in Uganda, but somehow every Rwandan around the area was auntie and uncle. And those are things
absolutely.
We took for granted.
The idea of community, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yes.
Right. And talk about the role of the community. You were talking about this instance in Uganda that was kind of an inflection point for you with these kids who were abused by their relatives in the school. What does the community do to reinforce these batons?
I think actually I can even generalize globally, especially around this issue. The biggest and worst baton that exists is that of silence. Everyone, even those who mean well, either people don't know how to talk about it, or there's this shame around not only the survivor that feels that shame, but even the families. So they try to hide it, that this is happening. One, because there's a cognitive dissonance that, and we know over, and I'm making up this statistic, but most of these perpetrations happen in the families.
It's people you know.
It's people you know, but we're only told about the stranger. Like, all the children are taught stranger danger. If you don't know that person, run away. But the people doing harming them are the people indoors. And when that happens, and this is Uncle so-and-so, and this is the pastor of the community, and this is the respected individual, the first thing that the community faces, first of all, that child or that person is going to be really scared to reveal that somebody everybody respects and loves did something terrible to them. And when they finally do that, most people will say, you're making up stuff.
So the instinct is to protect the abuser, the perpetrator.
Yes.
And before actually attending to the
survivor, the victim of this crime. Because our brains are meant to protect us. So if we're believing that somebody we love, respect, and admire could do something this terrible, that means our world is not safe. And that dysregulates us as a person. So this is, some of it is done unconsciously as a way that we would never wake up and get out of bed and function if we let all the possibilities be reality for us, right? So your brain is partly taking care of this for you as a parent, as a person to navigate the world. So if I believe that my pastor is abusing my child and the teacher, the coach could be doing this, then my children will never do anything. I'm going to lock them up and forever be here. But because of that, even when we have evidence, we refuse to see it so that we can keep our nice, safe facade of a world we want to live in. And that's where the problem happens. Then more survivors don't speak up. When they do speak up, people deny it, that this didn't happen or can't happen. So-and-so can't possibly do that to you. And then when they get past that and they push through that phase, then there is the corruption of the justice system. So it is
a victim is often hesitant to speak out because they know that there will be no action taken to address the issue, or they're muzzled by the community they're silenced by the community not to speak out.
I think a little bit of both. Well, there's that internal part for the victim. The first minute is there's the guilt. There is the shame. They feel like maybe I could have done something. Why did I let this? The self-blame. That's usually the first piece that stops them from speaking up. It's like, why did I? And of course, those are also messages that I've been given. This is the only crime when it happens that everybody asks what the victim was doing to deserve this, right? If you're mugged, if there's a murder, then I'm like, well, you shouldn't walk around with a nice purse. That's why somebody stole it. You know, and then somebody's raped, it's like, well, what were you wearing? Were you drunk? Were you this? So blame is always put on the victim first. So that's the first thing that stops them from sharing. The second part is the history of not being believed. You know, like we've seen it from Anita Hill to Dr. Ford to, these are like big cases in the U.S. that have implications on really powerful.
High profile cases, absolutely.
Very high profile cases. Yeah. Now imagine a little poor girl from
somewhere,
right? So you see how that it's global.
It's like pushing against the wall. It's tough.
Yeah,
it is tough. And over the years, have you seen any changes in that community based on some of the work that you've done? Have you seen the attitudes among either the elders or the, you know, the grown-ups? Do you have seen that changing?
Yes. And it was the change happened. I mean, it's been maybe what, 6 years now since we started. But the last time we saw 3,000 people come out to a march, we've been doing awareness on radio shows and talking about this issue. And that was partly my motivation to come out and share my story, right? Like, that's not an identity anybody wants, especially in our culture, it's so stigmatized. But to show that it can happen to anyone, and then for survivors, that it's not the end of your life. I've seen people who had been police officers now making arrests. So when they would ask for transport, I bought a motorcycle and hired a legal advocate. So when they want transport in the form of money. I'm like, oh, we have transport. They'll come pick you up and take you to your job. And so kind of tackling the problem where the root is, educating boys and men. So now we have, I recruited Boda Bodas, the motorcycle taxi, but men. I'm like, you guys are young. You are influential. You know the community better than anyone. It's giving everybody purpose and value to feel like they're part of the solution. This is not capitalist solution. I'm not the expert. What does the community need?
Yeah.
So and now
I think the most difficult part is just changing the attitudes and perceptions around this issue. Because even just talking about sex, aside from just the crime of it, you know, in cases where there's crime committed, just the issue of sex is that stigma. It's a taboo topic. But you know, you spoke about men. What would you say is the role of men as allies in tackling this issue?
Oh, if it was up to me, this work would be done just by men. So patriarchy is the root of all evil, in my opinion, of all things wrong in the world.
I will not disagree with you on that one.
And it affects men too.
Absolutely.
It comes up as so we come down to what is your role in this society? And I have the elders, the older men coming in for trauma training, believe it or not, in this rural area. And they got trained on trauma, the effects of it. And as men in this culture, they're seen as protectors, right? They're providers. And so what can you do to protect and provide for your family if not make sure that all the women, girls, and boys are protected? And they wanted to be in on that. So they became the safe keepers of the community. They have those who are trained, they put like little yellow flags in front of their house. So if a girl is going to fetch water, she doesn't feel safe, this man, she can knock on this safe house and the man will walk her to the well and back home safely. The Boda Boda guys, like, you guys can keep, you're the ears and the eyes of the community. If you did your job, trust me.
Can you say something?
Yes. And so now they got vests that says I'm a sexual gender-based violence advocate.
Oh, wow.
So they are the safe Boda Bodas. Now they get more business because more women feel safe.
Right.
And they have their names on it. So now they're also being accountable in the community.
But were they also perpetrated in some way as part of, you know, this public transportation system?
Yeah. Stereotypically, most of them are the perpetrators. Wow. When we were starting out, they used to actually threaten my social workers, like, oh, okay, here comes the rape girl. One day we will do this. Mm. And now they're like, what can we do? How can we be part of this?
Amazing. The transformation is amazing.
It's having people see themselves in it. When it's like a women issue, then it's like, okay, they'll take care of it. If it's like a climate issue that I don't see how it affects me, as humans, we're just selfish.
There's an inclination to distance yourself from issues.
Yeah.
That's not my problem. That's somebody else's problem. Let them deal with it. Tabitha, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me and for the work you do.
Absolutely. All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
And with that, we come to the end of our show today. Many thanks to our guest, Tabitha Mamira, a mental health therapist and activist against sexual and gender-based violence. She was joining us from Michigan. And many thanks to you who sent in your opinions on our Vox Pop series on the streets in Africa. Remember to connect with us on our social media platforms. We are on Facebook, on Twitter, and on Instagram. Until next time, I'll catch you right here on Upfront. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. Have a nice week ahead, Africa.
Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa.